From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton, sitting in for Jeffrey Callison. In a few minutes, I'll speak with base jumper Shane McConkie as he prepares to jump off of the Silver Legacy Casino in Reno, as well as hear some new music from Ozo Motley, who will be visiting us in the studio. But first, Ha Jin was a graduate student at Brandeis University when Chinese soldiers shot on protesters at Tiananmen Square in 1989. Deciding not to return to his native land, he instead began teaching and writing. His 1999 novel, Waiting, won the National Book Award, and his fourth novel, A Free Life, has just been published. He will be interviewed tonight by Insight's Jeffrey Callison at 7:30 at the Crest Theater. Ha Jin, welcome to Insight.
Very happy to be here.
Great. I was curious when I was surprised to learn that you were a soldier in the People's the Army of the People's Republic of China when you were very young. You were 14 years old?
Yes, from 14 to 19, yes.
And what inspired, that was younger than legal age to go into the military, wasn't it?
Yes, my father was an officer, so one of his brother division, they accepted some kids from my father's unit, mm-hmm. But the age at the time was 16. I lied about my age because all my pals, they were going, so that's why I went with them together.
Wow, and this was in 1969, was the height of the Cultural Revolution.
Yes.
The Army seems like a strange place for an aspiring poet to want to be.
At the time, I didn't know what to do because we were supposed to fight the Russians
right.
Because there were border skirmishes between the two countries, and so it was very, very tense at the time, mm-hmm. and we didn't think we would come back at the time,
uh-huh.
But a year later the border came down, and so we were kind of confused what to do in a peaceful time.
And you were, how long did you serve? You served for 5 years?
Five and a half.
Five and a half. Yeah. What do you remember most about that time?
I think the first 2 months, in the recruitment companies, there were two companies of that kind in the regiment, and we were new, and so we didn't have enough food to eat in the first 2 months,
mm-hmm.
especially vegetables. Most vegetables were put on the roofs, frozen, turnips and the cabbages. But once those were frozen, they were very bitter. So that I had memory of that.
Huh. And did you, it seems that being a writer would have been frowned upon during the Cultural Revolution in particular. The colleges were closed for, 10 years?
Yes, and sure. At the time, I think a lot of people did write. For instance, even in the army, we were supposed to write articles, propaganda work,
mm-hmm.
so that we would read them in the dining hall in front of your comrades.
Oh,
so
really?
Yeah, a lot of people wrote that way,
mm-hmm.
not a book, because very few books were published. I mean, literary books. There were not many books published at the time.
And were you reading mostly poetry at that point?
No, I had two books. One was a little red book, quotations from Chairman Mao. The other one is a bigger red book, selected works by Chairman Mao.
So
for first year and a half, basically, I had only two books.
And then you came to the United States to study at Brandeis.
Yes.
And you were studying English literature.
Yes, mainly modern poetry, yes.
Mm-hmm. And when did you start actually learning English?
After I left the army, and I began to work in a railroad company, and in the year 1976, the small city where I work, the city is called Jiangsu. It's a medium-sized city. And that year, the city started a learner's program on the radio from 5:30 to 6 in the morning, 6 days a week. So that's how I started, very basic, for half hour a day. But then the next year, college started. We could take exams and if successful, we could get into a college. And then I became an English major because I knew some words. Mm-hmm. And at the time, very few people knew English.
And you, did you speak or did you mostly read English at that point?
Oh, I didn't do anything. I just basically, there were lessons there. Mm-hmm. You know, very simple. It's long, live, chairman, more. Is this a table? Is that a chair? So I, before I went to college, I had never met another person who spoke English. So it was not a matter whether I could speak or, I think I just could recognize some words, could make sense of some sentences. Mm-hmm. And that's why we were given a written text. And also there was an oral kind of a very brief conversation, but I couldn't make sense of what the teacher said. But somehow I was accepted by Heilongjiang University as an English major.
And then how long did you study for a couple of years there and then came to the United States?
Yeah, after that, in fact, and I went to Shandong University to study American literature for 3 years. And after that, I came to the United States to do graduate work in American literature.
And then you saw, I'm assuming you saw the Tiananmen Square massacre on television, like
yeah,
everyone else?
Sure, yes. And at the time, I was finishing my dissertation, and I thought I would be back to China in half a year. And then the tragedy happened. I was in a shock for several weeks, couldn't function, and later decided to immigrate.
And why did you saw it? Because in the book you talk about the character's son talking about the uncles in the People's Republic Army fighting people who
sure.
were against the government,
sure.
and you were obviously very sympathetic to the government at that point. But that, did that change with Tiananmen Square, or is that something that had changed over time?
I think, you know, the Tiananmen tragedy was a turning point. Before that, and because I had always planned to return to China, no matter what, that's the place where I was going to live and work. And also, my son was still in China at the time. Then after the massacre, he came to the States. And at the time, I remember clearly we went to San Francisco to meet him, to collect him. And the first thought occurred to me was that he must be an American. And I wasn't sure about my own life because I was still in confusion. But for him, I wanted him to get out of the cycle of suffering and violence.
Mm-hmm. And that's also the opening of your book.
In a way, yes. That part is somehow more or less autobiographical.
Mm-hmm.
But the big story of the book is not, because the protagonist is much closer, his life is much closer to a common immigrant's life. I live a very much more fortunate life. I had a full-time teaching position, and in fact, soon after I graduated from Brandeis. But this guy, he struggled for a whole decade, basically getting nowhere.
Mm-hmm. And you, if you'd gone back to China instead of staying in the United States, political considerations aside, would you have become a college professor and writer there as well?
I don't think I would be a writer. I think I would have become a professor. Maybe if I had worked hard, I could have become a decent scholar, translator of American literature. That's all I could imagine at the time.
Mm-hmm. And what was it about American literature that was so appealing to you as opposed to Chinese literature? China has a very rich heritage in literature
sure,
as well.
Sure. And what happened is in the year 1981, when I was a junior in college, suddenly, somehow, American literature became immensely popular. People began to talk about Faulkner, Hemingway, and Bellow, and Malamud. But very few of the professors had read the originals because books were not available. But people talk. So the more they talked, the more fascinating the subject became. So as a result, a lot of young people were very eager to make sense of American literature. So I was one of them. I began to work very hard on English in order to get into a master's program to study American literature.
So people, let me get this straight. People were talking about Faulkner and Hemingway, but nobody was really having a chance to read them much.
Except a few people in Beijing and Shanghai, they had access to the books in the English, and they wrote criticism. So basically, the professors at the provincial colleges, they just deliver lectures based upon criticism written by other scholars.
That's an interesting little game of literary telephone, almost.
Sure.
Have your books been published in China at all?
When Waiting was published and then went out of print. And other than that, the other books are not allowed to be published. In fact, a Shanghai publisher announced 3 times in last year, and they planned to bring out 5 of my books. I still have the contracts. And then they sent my short story collection Under the Red Flag to the censorship department, but that was shut down. As a result, the whole project was abandoned.
I imagine that War Trash, which was a book about the Korean War, would not have made the censors in China very happy.
And they didn't. Even the publisher didn't touch that book. The contract excluded that book.
Really?
And the Craze and the War Trash, these are politically very sensitive, so they wouldn't bother about those.
Wow. Now, this new book, A Free Life, it took 6 years to write.
Seven years to write.
It's been characterized as a book that has been that was a risk for you.
Yes.
What's that notion based on?
The risk mainly, I think, is from the writing, from the point of view of a writer, because now the subject is new, the setting is different, and people, all the characters, they speak English and different kinds of English and the Chinese as well, and so a lot of us devices or techniques I had invented for my other books would not apply anymore. So I have to struggle to come up with new things for this book. So for me, it was a big struggle.
Mm-hmm. And so it was getting across was it the spoken English that was hard to communicate, or?
Sure, that's part of it. Spoken English, there are native speakers and also non-native speakers, immigrants who speak different kinds of English. In addition to that, the references here, they affect you. I have to be very careful. They have to be accurate. Whereas if I work on a book set in China, basically I occupied a privileged space because the readers do not know much about it, the references. So my job, my task would be not to abuse the privilege, try to really be truthful. But in case of this book, I had to be very cautious because there's always an actual world around us. So the book is, in other words, close to American daily life. That's why, for me, it was more demanding.
Mm-hmm. Now, is the title ironic? Because the character, Nan Wu, he's a free man and he's in this new country. But you imply that it takes him a very long time to understand how to handle.
Yeah. I think it really depends on how we interpret the title or the story. In his case, I think he knew the price, the cost of freedom, but he was willing to pay and to really accept that isolation and frustration, even failure, as the price for freedom. That's fine. And I think by doing that also, he has become a better man. That's the truth. And in the beginning, he emotionally or mentally, he was not that mature. But the immigrant process, the big struggle, eventually toughened him up and make him a better man. And so in that sense, this can be also read as a coming-of-age story.
Mm-hmm. And it's the opening scene where he meets his son in the airport, which we referenced earlier, and it echoes your experience to a degree. But he has a very strange relationship with both his wife and his child.
He
stands off a lot from both of them.
Yes. I think because, you know, he lived, I think partly because he didn't, like, he had not lived with them. He was in the state and others, you know, took 4 years for them to be together. And so, but gradually, at another point, you know, his wife asked him, "You promised you would never leave him." And he snapped, "Where could I go? You two are all I have." So I think gradually, he has become a better husband, a better father.
Mm-hmm. Do you find it odd to be so celebrated, the Penn Faulkner Award, you were even nominated for the Pulitzer Prize, for writing in a language that's not your first language? Because language is often thought of as something that is very deeply seated.
And
just to reach the level that you have in a language you've been speaking, what, 20?
Twenty-something years.
Remarkable. Do you find that odd?
In a way, yes. But you know, also I think I do feel there's a tragic sense of, you know, writing in another language which I can never feel at home, but I have to struggle. And there is a tradition in the English language in which non-native speakers became essential writers. So there is a tradition, and there's nothing original here. And I traveled the way opened by Conrad Nabokov. And at the same time, I think like them, there is a sense of being crippled. That's why I think I share Nabokov's statement that to write English for him is a private tragedy.
I'm sorry.
To write in English is a private tragedy, he said.
Because he may have done so much more in his own language.
Maybe. I think in essence, it's not a matter whether he write better in this language or that language. It is in a language he did not feel at home. At the same time, he gave his best creative years to English. And in fact, in the interview, he said something like, the switching from Russian prose to English prose was very painful to him. It was like learning how to handle things after an explosion, after lost 7 or 8 fingers. So the being sense of crippledness, I think I do share that.
But after the number of books that you've written, it must be easier now, or does the subject make it harder still?
No. Every book is a big risk and certain, uncertain. And in a way, I think, but I can't accept that, the uncertainty as part of the process. I think even for native-speaking writers, and still uncertainty is always part of the process. And in a way, it's not a bad thing if you are sure of everything. The book cannot be an outstanding book. And there is always kind of risk involved.
And have you ever written in Mandarin or in?
Before I came to the States, I had written some poems, but I had never published. And nowadays, and occasionally, I would write an essay or article in Mandarin. But I don't write creative work in Chinese.
Do you think you ever will?
I don't think so, because it still is a big struggle for me just to survive in English. And once the decision was made, I have to travel along the way. Life is too short. I cannot afford to switch back and forth.
Because that learning curve would just be so steep,
yes.
Even though that's your native tongue.
True. Yeah, that's the situation. But it doesn't mean I will really separate myself completely from the Chinese heritage and the language. That's part of my past. It would be impossible. But I have to think, where is my really the principal investment for my life? And that is in the English language now. Because I spent so many years, worked so hard, and I have to continue to travel alone.
And you teach literature.
Yes.
And so you're teaching the American or Anglo-American literature tradition all the time anyway, so you really are in that.
Yes, I also teach fiction writing. So that's why, in other words, English is my livelihood, daily existence. So it would be silly for me to really work in Chinese, then I would speak Chinese in classroom.
Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Now, have you returned to China?
No, I haven't.
Because Nan does, and he has that scene where he returns and he gives his parents $1,000 that he's worked so hard to get.
Sure.
And they don't really seem to get it.
And they thought that he was such a rich man. They were amazed, yes. And that's part, you see, that's different from my life. He returned. Also, he found, in fact, he was more or less, he was a foreigner by then and in his native land. And he was eager to return to Georgia. This was not just himself. I often hear, I have friends who went back to China and they would say, you know, I miss home. I say, where is home? What do you mean, miss home? I say, home in Connecticut or Georgia or Virginia. Yeah, that was very common.
And is there a sense, is your work regarded differently in among, what do you call them, ABCs, American Born Chinese, and immigrants? Do you have a different, are those two different audiences?
I don't think that audiences are very, very different, but I think the subject matters may be different because the ABCs basically write, you know, the second and the third generations. You know, they write about their parents or grandparents' experience or their own experience and struggle with their parents. So the subject matter is different from my because I came as an adult immigrant. So the subject matter is basically about the beginning of these adult immigrants. And in that sense, maybe even style can be very different as well, because ABC can easily soaked in American pop culture. Mm-hmm. But for an adult immigrant, that is a difficult thing because your sensibility and a lot of things had been shaped by your old land.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're on that subject, and since Nan Wu's desire was always to write poetry, at the end of the book you have a number of his poems.
Yes.
Which are, of course, your poems. And I would love it if you would read one for us.
Sure, let me read this one. This one's called Homeland. You patch the pouch of earth into your baggage as a bit of your homeland. You told your friend, in a few years I'll be back like a lion. There's no other place I can call home, and wherever I go, I'll carry our country with me. I'll make sure my children speak our language, remember our history, and follow our customs. Rest assured, you will see this same man, made of loyalty, bringing back gifts and knowledge from other lands. You won't be able to go back. Look, the door has closed behind you. Like others, you too are expendable to a country never short of citizens. You will toss in sleepless nights, confused, homesick, and weeping in silence. Indeed, loyalty is a ruse if only one side intends to be loyal. You will have no choice but to join the refugees and change your passport. Eventually, you will learn your country is where you raise your children. Your homeland is where you build your home.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Hajin, for visiting us today on Insight. You will be speaking tonight at, or being interviewed tonight by Jeffrey Callison at the Crest Theater at 7:30. And thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm David Watts Barton. We'll be back in a few moments with Ozo Motley. Listening to Insight from KXJZ, I'm David Watts Barton. Next time on Insight, an Argentinian artist who explores human rights and civil war in her work has an exhibit in Sacramento. Claudia Bernardi talks about her art and her experiences in El Salvador. Also, you'll meet award-winning jugglers the Raspini Brothers. They're performing in Grass Valley this weekend. Plus, Reno author Renee Reed tells you about her latest book. It's a love story set in Sacramento and features the Attorney General. Right now, though, I'm joined by two members of Ozo Motley.
Yes.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
We're here.
Ozo Motley has changed a number of members over the years since they first started.
We're still all the same.
They'll be playing tonight at Sac State. In what is a return engagement of many times. You guys have played there a lot of times.
This is an annual thing for us. We love coming. Yeah, it is a tradition. We've been coming here for, I don't know how many years, playing in that ballroom. And, you know, it's a really good time.
It's not the greatest sounding place, but it's a fun place.
Yeah.
Before we go any further, why don't you introduce yourselves?
I'm Raul Pacheco. I sing and play guitar.
My name is Jiro, and I play percussion.
And are you both original members of the band?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
We're the ones who have to do this.
How much has it changed? Because it was you have a promotional shot with 10 people, you have a promotional shot with 8 people, and I'm told you've got 7 people tonight.
Well, when we first started, we had 15 people. So go figure. It's pretty easy to do math.
It's a concept, so it can just evolve, you know. There's a nebulous.
Now, you were discovered playing in an Indian restaurant, is that what I understand?
Yeah, man, I was playing in an Indian restaurant. A few guys in the band came walking in, kind of like the Blues Brothers, you know? Have you ever seen Getting the Band Back Together? And I was just like, yeah, you know what? This job sucks, and I'm going to join the band. No, I was actually doing a weekly gig at an Indian restaurant, and that's just what I happened to be doing at the time.
The other story was cooler.
And where did you come from, your guitar player?
You know, it's funny enough, I was...
You came from here.
Yeah, I was going to school here in Sac State.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Sacramento connection.
I grew up in L.A., though, and I just decided, you know what, I need to get back into playing music. I went back to school, and there was this jam going on, and I was invited, and I've been here ever since. It's been one long jam.
And were you studying music?
No, I was studying political science.
Oh.
Yeah.
Hobnobbing with, you know, the politicos.
Well, political science has certainly played a major role in what you guys do, too.
I mean, I think for all of us, like, we have been involved in different levels in politics and street politics and just what people call activism. And I think for us, it's just we care, you know, the most part. And so we take a stand and we support certain issues and we let it be known, you know. So, and I think that that's been since the get-go.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk a little bit about your tour we've toured all over the world this year, but I thought we'd play a little bit of one of the songs from the new album.
Cool.
Don't Mess with the Dragon.
Don't Mess with the Dragon, which is your fourth studio album.
It is.
And then you've also got a live album and an EP.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. This is a song, it's the opening song on the album. It's called Can't Stop, Ozo Motley. Boom, 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 boom. That beat is really interesting, and I remember a few years ago when I first started hearing reggaeton, and it sounded like Rai music from Algeria, and you guys just toured the Middle East a little bit, or a portion of it.
We were right by Algeria.
But you've included Arab music in your music for a long time. You were playing Indian music, which is somewhat related.
Yeah.
How do you describe that beat? We sort of joked about you guys are like the ultimate hyphenated band. But what is that beat?
And, so, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2.
For regular people, what is that beat?
I don't know. It's kind of a universal beat, actually, because if you look at or listen to music from around the world, you'll find that beat everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's everywhere. Everybody plays it. So, you know, with maybe a couple exceptions.
The Inuit.
Bruce Springsteen hasn't played that beat yet.
Yeah.
But it's funny, after 9/11, it seemed to me that that beat became more prevalent in a lot of American popular music. There was a Beyoncé song that had that beat.
I think what we've been introduced to it more is like what you said, reggaeton. And, mm-hmm. But there is definitely a connection. And what we find when we make music is that we're always surprised by these kinds of, hey, it's almost like this, or it's just like this. And it just kind of reminds us that, you know, we all are connected in that kind of deep way, and of traditions, and that there's some similarities there all the time.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah. And that a lot of those lines are pretty artificially drawn.
Yeah, oh, totally. I mean, come on. You know, there's, you know, I mean, for us, it's like being from L.A., like the issue of a border is like, you know, it's kind of a joke. You know, and we don't, none of us think that it should be the stance that the government is taking at the moment is something that we support at all.
Mm-hmm. You know, so. And speaking of that, you did do this tour under the auspices of the State Department.
Yeah, we got paid by the government. Wow.
From the Bush administration.
Yeah, how about that?
Which is not who I was expecting.
We were not
sending Ozu Motley as a...
Yeah, we didn't expect the call either.
How did that come about?
That came about... It was actually a long time in the making. We did an NPR interview years ago. And it's a woman named Sharon. I don't remember her last name, but she worked in the government, and she was in D.C. at the time, she ended up in Nepal, and she was like, she was actually the initiator in trying to get us to come and be what they call cultural ambassadors, you know, to the United States and go play, you know, American music in places like India and Kathmandu, and, you know, it's a program that's been going on for years, you know, use jazz musicians, and I think it's not only artists, it's also architects, it's also, you know, people from all different walks of life, you know, I guess the governments like to show them off to other peoples, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, they asked us to do it, and we were like, India? Kathmandu? Yeah, we'll go,
yeah.
You know, and we'll do what we do. And it was interesting because we met them. We were in Delhi, I think we were in. We met the main guy of the embassy there, and he was like, he was just giving us the lowdown on India and, you know, the politics and what they were doing there and, you know, the kind of work that they do. And we just, you know, he was cool. He, you know, but we were kind of like, do you know who we are? Because it was the first thing we've done, you know, we were like just kind of introduced to them. We're like, do you really know who we are and what we do and where we've been? And, you know, have you looked at our website? And,
uh-huh. And you're not a typical folkloric kind of embassy playing.
Yeah, I mean, we have politics, you know, we're against the war. We don't like George Bush, you know, and we're vocal about it, you know. So that was like, we were kind of like... just asking the question, you know, is that, do you understand that? And mm-hmm. they were totally understanding. And, you know, they it wasn't about not voicing that opinion to them. It was more about them wanting to show the world, you know, whatever they dug about us, that's what they wanted to show mm-hmm. Show people.
What people did you show? What were the audiences like, and where did you play?
It was really mixed. I mean, there was definitely like some people who were, you know, involved in foreign service from different countries, and then there was just people out in the street sometimes. It was really varied because we would do outreach, you know, we'd have our own shows, like proper Ozu Motley shows, and then we'd go play at an orphanage maybe, you know, and we would do that a lot, things like that. And then we would make these connections with those kinds of people and invite them to the show, so then they would come, and then there would be foreign service, and all the situations were different. So mm-hmm. that was kind of cool. You know, it was like one day we'd be at a hotel where all the embassy people are. The next day we were in playing out in the Shivaratri festival in Nepal, which is like, it wasn't for the festival, but it was the same time that it was going on, with like 300,000 people hanging out, praying to Shiva.
And it's a religious festival, not a rock festival.
Right. And then, you know, but then we were playing downtown and anybody could come. Just people just came and showed up and were like, what's this about? And so it was really interesting, like the whole varied kind of experience of it all.
And then you also went, this was in Nepal and India, and then you also went to Tunisia, Jordan, and Egypt.
Yeah.
Yep.
What was that like?
That was awesome.
Yeah.
And it was kind of similar in the sense that, like what Raul just said, and the kinds of shows we did, it was ranging for everything from just like foreign service people and expats one day, and then doing a show in like Aqaba, which was like, you know, right downtown, and just regular local people, you know, and
we played in
and
the
then
park.
Us. And it was just kind of really strange experience because we don't really know what to expect and how people are going to react to us, you know?
Who was the best audience?
That was one of our best shows.
In Aqaba?
Because it was like...
Well, that's a resort, too.
It was
too,
kind
though.
Of a weird vibe while we were setting up.
And there is that element of it, but where we played in the park, it was the site of the Arab revolt, and it just a neighborhood people. It was just this neighborhood, and we just played in the park. And that's what we used to do when we started. We were just sure. So it was really interesting to kind of be in that situation, and it was really cool just to meet everyday people. I think one of the motivations for us saying yes to this was, you know, and kind of transcending whatever kind of negativity we could get. Well, oh, you're working for the government or something like that. It was just like, you know, we just want to meet people and kind of come to some impressions on ourselves and just meet them face to face and just, you know, build our own story between one another rather than hearing it through the paper or through the media and just kind of do it on our own.
I want to hear another song from the album. This one is City of Angels, which is sort of the song for your hometown.
Yeah,
about a lot of what you're talking about. Yeah. So let's listen to City of Angels from the new album, Don't Mess with the Dragon.
Let me tell you a little something about L.A.
I love it!
What you know about my city, that's tic-tac. Hustle to get stacks, fail, get laughed at. Even from here, I hear the chit-chat. Grew up, Miracle Mile, Fairfax, the tall traps. Hamilton High, alumni, what you know? Ham and cheese, Supreme, JB the Quartet Cat. L.A., it be the base and the catalyst. Walk Crescent Heights, worldwide, back to strangle us. Land of the saint and the land of the wicked. Hollywood, the bell, the man of Kenya Kevin. World of duality, air in reality. Devin Brown shot, minor technicality. Brad Pitt's cheating, front page reality. Stanley Miller beating, D.A. don't want to touch it.
And that's Ozo Motley from their new album, Don't Mess with the Dragon. They are going to be at Sac State tonight at the University Union. And we're going to take a little break and then come back and talk a little bit more.
Cool.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm David Watts Barton, and I'm in the studio with a couple guys from Ozo Motley. We were just listening to some of the music.
Yeah, man. Right on. You know, you're doing a really great job, and I think you deserve a raise already.
They're going to be playing tonight at Sac State in the Student Union at, we got conflicting information. Is it 6:30 or 7:30?
Let's add to that confusion.
Okay, 7:30. I'm told the voice in my ear says 7:30.
Just show
so that's
up early
good.
And hang out with us, man. Drink coffee, have a soda. Talk about the times.
You guys address a lot of different issues in the songs, and I noticed in that song that we played before the break that you actually used the word Manichaean.
Mm-hmm. That's Justin's delving into. You know, he's trying to be a wordsmith as an MC and. He reaches for it all, you know? That's what you got to do.
Yeah, I think somebody sort of gave him a shout over the top of that to kind of loosen it up a little bit. But you guys have made, this is your fourth studio album, and you have been on several different labels now. I think you're on your third label now.
Yeah.
As much as labels even matter anymore.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you find yourselves in the position of being one of those bands like the Grateful Dead back in the day where it was like great live, don't come across on record. It doesn't sound that way to me, but I've heard people say that. Is that something that you guys have worked with? Is this album much different? Or
I think we've progressed, you know, because we are known for our live show, and our first record came directly from our live show. And so we had the songs already written. We were playing them for a couple of years before we even recorded it. And ever since then, we haven't had that luxury, really. Although we do write a lot when we're just jamming and playing live, ideas do come out. But, you know, now that we're on a fourth record, I think it's more about making the record than trying to take necessarily what we do live and translating that onto tape or the hard drive, whatever you want to call these things. Yeah. You know, it's not about that. I think it was that for our first record, and since then that's not the case.
And so you do things that you may not even be able to reproduce live, but you want to make the record sound better.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's like, for, you know, the end of the day, too, I think records at this point are really, I mean, they always have been, but they're just a promotional tool. You know, you get it out to something that, and I think we've tried to make commercial records a little bit more each time. Like, well, that's really what it's for in our eyes. It's like, okay, well, you want to play it on the radio? Well, will this work? Mm-hmm. Will it not? Who knows? I think we tried that because that seemed to be, well, you know, that's what we're getting money to do to make this record. And but we just do what we want to do every time. As long as we're happy with it, CD, live show, we sleep well.
Well, and the way record sales are going, you're going to look like geniuses for being great live.
Man, we planned this the whole time.
We saw it coming.
We knew it.
I just read something in the Chronicle yesterday saying that there's a band in Germany that did a subscription for their album, and they established a website and put a counter on there to say how much money they needed, and then it counted down. And when they got the money from people subscribing, then they started making the record, and they put webcams in the studio and let people talk about the and contribute to the recording of the album.
I don't know if I'm down for that.
Yeah,
they can
like
watch that, though. No,
you already
joking.
Have enough cooks in this whole thing. It
yeah,
sounds
man.
Like. In fact, there were some interesting references on your website to Creative Conflict and what was the other one?
Yeah, man.
There was. I wasn't sure whether that was.
You know, that's it sounds nicer than straight up hatred. So you know.
What is that process for 7 or 8 or 10 or however many guys there are in the studio
it's
working
a
on a record?
I mean, we joke a lot. You know, I think one of the jokes you say, it's the last man standing. But, you know, it's a negotiation. And I think the concept of this band that we've all learned that's kind of been able to apply to life is like there's a lot more going on than just you. And how do you find fulfillment in kind of getting really checking in with yourself? Like, what do I really need to get creatively out of this process? Being committed to that, but also knowing, oh man, you know, there's a lot of people, and I gotta listen to them too if I want them to listen to me. And it's not easy, you know. I don't think we're taught that, you know, growing up, and so it's been a good thing for us to learn how to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you decide? Now, you don't really have a primary songwriter. You guys are all throwing in, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's open for anyone, and it's kind of like whatever ideas resonate the most. If you write an idea and all the other guys go, yeah, then you know it's cool. But if they go, I don't know, then you know, okay, it's not going to work. That's pretty much it.
And you probably learned to back off pretty quickly
that
crowd.
Just don't take it personally. these particular guys don't like it. It's okay.
And you guys kind of also walk a bit of a knife's edge between political commentary and good times music, right?
Yeah.
And party music.
Yeah.
And one song on the album, though, that we could listen to a little bit, it was called Magnolia Soul, mm-hmm. which is about Katrina, and it kind of takes the Bush administration to task mm-hmm. for the response. But it's also got a great New Orleans mm-hmm. feel as interpreted by Ozo Motley.
Yeah, we have a great relationship with that city. You know, I think everybody in the band loves it. We've been going there for years, and just the culture, the food, the people, and the vibe of that city is something we really gravitate towards as a band. And so when we saw what had happened, it was, you know, I mean, it's kind of really telling when the government, for such a cultural treasure as a city like that, for the government to turn their backs like that is a real sad statement, you know, and it just shows where the priorities are. And Justin came up with the idea to kind of make a tribute to that city.
His family's from there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
so okay. I think that was a personal connection for him.
Okay. Well, let's listen to a little bit of Magnolia Soul from Don't Mess With the Dragon from Ozo Motley.
Been a long time since I last saw your face. Never forget the day out in the sticks. us on your crescent smiling place. All the way from uptown, downtown, lakeside the river. Heard W, don't care about this. Gotta watch who you make your friend. Otherwise, people come through and backstab you again. Just some advice to men. We ties have been through the dark, true light will win. And they said that this the end, but we fixing to make them saints march on again.
All right, that's Magnolia Soul from the new album Don't Mess with the Dragon by Ozo Motley. And you talk about the good having the good times roll in there. And
you know, there's a celebration even sometimes when things are not good in your life. Sometimes it's important to get together with people and recognize that we're all still alive, you know, and that there's still plenty to do, there's plenty to live for. And I think that song kind of has that vibe, and that's something that's within us too. It's like, you know, as a group, we are a bunch of fun guys when we're together. You know, we're not all that serious all the time. I think for us, you know, it's appropriate. It's like there's certain times in our lives when it's appropriate to be serious and to be that way. And it's appropriate to just kind of let your hair down, so to speak, and just have a good time. And we're musicians. And so when we're bringing people together, it really is about celebrating what we have now, you know, celebrating this moment. Who knows when we're all going to be together at our shows? We have disparate groups come. We have kids. We have parents, grandparents, we have students, you know, black, white, Chicano, Latino, whatever. And it's, for us, it's all a good thing. And so I think we always want to recognize that, and everyone, that let's get together and have a good time, you know.
Do you ever get, in these travels, you must have heard some new music that you hadn't heard before.
Always. Yeah.
Do you get stuff that you sort of put in the back of your head, I'd like to add that later? Or are there certain things that come along and you just sort of think, not Ozo Motley? I mean, where do you sort of draw the lines around Ozo Motley when you do so much?
I think one of the things we do is if it feels good, if it feels natural, because we can't, it's like, you know, a really good friend of mine said, you know, some of that Middle Eastern stuff you do, it's very on the surface. You know, it's not like the real deep, maybe understanding of. And I think on one idea, it's fair. You know, it's like we're not from that culture. None of us are. We dabble in it. We're kind of like paying homage to it. I think we're showing that we respect that music, you know, enough to just think that it's beautiful in its own right. So I think what we try to do is we know that we're not from every part of the world. So when we're delving into these other sounds, it's kind of like, we can be self-critical, but let's not, if we like it and we're having fun with it, you know, let's just go with it. If it feels good, if it seems natural, if it makes a song move. And, you know, so I think that's the way we judge it. You know, we kind of like write something, and if we're using a sound, a rhythm we've never done, does it work? Does it feel good? Does it make sense? Cool. Let's keep it in. If not, then we move on.
And you also have a danceability as a criteria?
Yeah, we're a dance band. Yeah, we sure are.
Because dance band always sounds like selling somebody short, and you guys are an incredibly complex musical experience as well.
I think we're trying to give that dance band label a little bit more weight.
But people come to shake it, right?
You got to, yeah.
They move, man.
I mean, that's what we do, you know. Everyone who comes to our show is going to move. If they don't, then we haven't done our job.
All right. Well, thanks for coming by, guys.
Cool, man. Thank you so much
for having us.
Have a great show tonight. That's again, Ozo Motley will be playing their unique blend of just about everything tonight at Sac State at 7:30 at the Student Union.
Yeah, plenty of tickets.
Plenty of tickets
Get
available.
Some coffee, a burrito, watch the show.
Thanks very much. And this is David Barton. This has been Insight. And coming up on Jay-Z, there are other stories and the rest of the day's business news next on Marketplace. Today's associate producer is Linnea Edmire. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us.
An Argentine artist who explores human rights and civil war in her work is an exhibit in Sacramento. On the next Insight, Claudia Bernardi talks about her art and her experiences in El Salvador. Also, you'll meet award-winning jugglers, the Raspini Brothers. They're performing in Grass Valley this weekend. Plus, Reno author Renee Reed tells you about her latest book. It's a love story set in Sacramento. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow at 2 on KXJZ.